From Indiana to Mexico, Lafayette Hill to Latrobe, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, a bailout of the nuclear power industry has resulted in a major political scandal in Ohio and led to the indictment of the state's House Speaker. Brian Augsburger of the Ohio Manufacturers Association joins David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association for a Capitol Watch look at the details. And despite a unanimous vote in the General Assembly, Governor Tom Wolf refused to sign the new right-to-work law, but it went into effect without his approval. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to David Taylor and Ryan Augsburger in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. A new report from the National Alcoholic Beverage Control Association shows sales of spirits in the month of June were up compared to last year in every state except Pennsylvania. In the other states tracked by the association, spirit sales were up 13.1% compared to last year, but in Pennsylvania, sales declined by 4.6%. Similar results were posted in March and April. The Commonwealth Foundation is pushing a number of reform measures currently before the General Assembly that would essentially end the state's monopoly on liquor sales. Pennsylvania and Utah are the only states in the nation to hold both the retail and wholesale distribution of liquor under government control. Pennsylvania's mail-in ballot program experienced a number of difficulties and delays in last June's primary. With a high turnout presidential election rapidly approaching, the Department of State is pushing lawmakers for additional changes, including requiring counties to mail out ballots earlier and give counties until the Friday after the election to count the ballots. The expanded mail-in program has raised concerns over ballot security and election fraud. In neighboring New York State, it was just this past week, election officials were able to complete counting ballots in two congressional districts for a primary that was held in June. Governor Tom Wolf continues to keep severe limits on bar and restaurant capacity, claiming that will help to slow the spread of COVID-19. But the restrictions, which limit restaurants to 25% of capacity, are forcing many to close their doors. John Longstreet, CEO of the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association, says the governor's policies will cause the permanent closure of as many as 7,500 restaurants. That would put some 200,000 people out of jobs. In the meantime, State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine has refused media requests to release the data. Officials say back up their claim bars and restaurants were responsible for an increase in COVID-19 cases in early July. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Federal prosecutors have indicted the Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives in what they term a $60 million pay-to-play bribery scheme to pass a bailout of the nuclear power industry in that state. Are there lessons to be learned relative to similar efforts in Pennsylvania? Ryan Augsburger is Vice President and Managing Director for Public Policy of the Ohio Manufacturers Association. He joins David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association for this Capitol Watch discussion. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. And today, there's been all kinds of news, actually from our neighbors to the west in the great state of Ohio, that they had a nuclear bailout piece of legislation passed, like the one that we've been fighting here in Pennsylvania. But there are late-breaking developments. It's the biggest sequel since The Godfather Part II. And to give us the whole story from Columbus, our good friend Ryan Augsburger, Vice President and Director of Public Policy for the Ohio Manufacturers Association. Ryan, thanks for being with us on the show.
Good afternoon, and thank you, David, for having me, and hello to our friends to the east. What a great introduction there.
Well, thanks for being with us, and longtime listeners will remember that Ryan was with us some time back to tell us about House Bill 6 and what had gone down, and I guess we'll start with the latest news and then go back to the origins of how all this came to pass. But it's the worst knock knock joke ever. Knock knock.
Who's there?
FBI.
FBI who?
No, really, it's the FBI. Open up. that Ohio Speaker of the House Larry Householder was actually wakened with that very unfortunate message just a few weeks ago. What's going on?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just over 2 weeks ago, Tuesday, July 21st, FBI agents arrested Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder at his home and his farm in southeast Ohio. The FBI also arrested four associates to the claim later that day. The federal government made its case. U.S. Attorney David DeVillers summarized the details of a $60 million federal bribery case.
Unreal.
It really is. It is the largest bribery money laundering scheme ever perpetrated against the people of the state of Ohio, according to the U.S. attorney. He characterized it as bribery, plain and simple. This was quid pro quo. This was pay to play. Those are direct quotes from the U.S. attorney at his press conference hours after agents arrested and detained the Ohio Speaker of the House and his associates.
And I read the charging document, and it's really striking the degree to which they lay out all of this, and it revolves around House Bill 6, the nuclear bailout, and the slush fund was through an entity called Generation Now, and that all this was paid for, much of it was paid for by Company A. Can you explain who is Company A?
Yes, there's so much to unpack in the 82-page affidavit that has been summarized and reported on as the federal government's case. But they're using the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, as the basis. That's a law that has been reserved to prosecute the highest levels of organized crime.
Yes.
And so this is the first time it's been used in the Southern District of Ohio, which is the Justice Department that has jurisdiction for this. And so the complaint, the federal complaint, indicates that the investigation into the speaker's activities that had been going on for some time, explains that money from Company A, which was in search of a solution to its nuclear energy problem, a little bit of a clue there, began flowing to the speaker in January 27, some of the monies that went, there was a trip on Company A's private jet. There were $250,000 payments that went to this dark money group controlled by Householder, allegedly by the group's name was Generation Now. But your question, David, was who is Company A? And while it's not named specifically in the 82-page affidavit of the federal government, it's pretty widely known that Company A is First Energy Corp.
And at the press conference that the U.S. attorney said that Company A was not explicitly named because the company has not been indicted yet. Those are words that would not help one to sleep at night. So what did the company get in return for all of this activity through the slush fund? This is how they got House Bill 6, I guess.
That's it. The federal government continues their investigation. They were very clear this is really the beginning, not the end. There have been no additional charges in the 2 weeks and a day since that time. So your knock knock joke, there's probably some others coming here. But what was the quid pro quo? What was the bags of cash? The bags of cash that were paid come in exchange for bags of cash that Ohio electricity customers, businesses like those I represent, as well as residential families, will be paying, that will go to the owners of the nuclear power plants. Ohio has just two of them. They're both owned by a former First Energy subsidiary that went through bankruptcy and emerged from bankruptcy earlier this year. That company is called Energy Harbor now. It used to be called First Energy Solutions and was a subsidiary to First Energy. So the benefit of the bill flows to Energy Harbor, the owner of the nuclear power plants, and that's $150 million per year for 6 years. So that's going to add up to $1 billion
plus. Yeah.
But then there were other provisions of House Bill 6 that will, and some of that, we don't know what the ownership structure looked like. I'm sure that will come to pass here in the future. But there were other provisions in House Bill 6 that are also very beneficial for the First Energy regulated distribution utility in Ohio.
And there are a couple of things that are important for the listeners to understand here. You know, Ryan, you and I, you know, you do in Columbus what I do in Harrisburg, which is we fight for manufacturers. And the manufacturers, the people who make things, you know, they're the ones who add the most value, have the strongest spinoff effect on job creation, have these, you know, jobs that pay, you know, above average wages and benefits. These are family sustaining jobs. The manufacturing sector drives the economy. No matter what it is that a manufacturer is making, inevitably that manufacturer is using a lot of energy. And this is why, you know, the pricing of energy and competitive markets are so important for the manufacturing sector. And also that, that this same company, Energy Harbor, First Energy Services, they also have a Pennsylvania facility right across the state line in they call the Beaver Valley facility in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. And so it was during the same window of time in Harrisburg. It was like the second half of 2018 and the first half of 2019 that you had First Energy and Exelon working Harrisburg hard in advance of their own nuclear bailout legislation. So these are issues that we've seen play out, you know, not just here in Pennsylvania or with you in Ohio, but in Illinois and New York and New Jersey. And so this, you know, it's a national effort on the part of manufacturers to try to defend competitive markets for electricity, because, you know, even if the price point moves a little bit, it can have huge impacts on the ability of manufacturers to succeed and be profitable.
Critically important points. Yes, these have we are in a position to defend markets. Markets are what deliver the best, not just price, but also reliability and innovation.
Yes.
And so it shouldn't be a surprise that manufacturers are tip of the spear in these kinds of battles. And as you pointed out, we've been fighting this for five or more years. In our case, we first saw First Energy attempt to get this this form of revenue through the regulatory process. So this began at the Public Utilities Commission in our state several years back. And when they got stymied there, actually they got their awarded the state regulatory panel awarded them the subsidy, and then the federal government at FERC said that was unfair against the rules of a fair market, and so they had to go back to square one, and that's when they dreamed up this scheme of going to the legislature. And so this playbook has been taking a lot of our focus for about a 5 year time period now.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor, from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me, my special guest, Ryan Augsburger, from the Ohio Manufacturers Association. And Ryan, the scandal around the nuke bailout bill didn't end just with the passage and signing of House Bill 6, that in your state that you guys have ballot initiatives. We don't have that in Pennsylvania, but you guys have that there, and that the business community and citizens got together to try to do a ballot issue to get the question of the bailout before the voters. And then that was another scheme that this slush fund was used to prevent the organizers from successfully putting the question on the ballot so that the citizens wouldn't get a vote.
Yeah, this dominated the months that followed the passage of the bill. So House Bill 6 passed just over a year ago and was signed immediately into law. But then during the 90 days before it became effective, the referendum effort was launched. We were not involved in that referendum directly or indirectly, for that matter. Certainly, we had members that were interested in it. But it was extremely controversial, and what we saw is that this dark money organization spent a tremendous amount of money to do to prevent the referendum from succeeding. They wanted to make sure that the law went into effect, and so they according to the federal government case, and this has been covered a lot in just the last day or two in media, they spent a lot of money hiring up all of the other signature collection vendors that are out there so that others couldn't be hired by the referendum side. And then most prominently, they launched a media campaign, many tens of millions of dollars, to scare Ohioans from giving a signature. They alleged that the people who were knocking at their doors to collect signatures were ex-cons, and that they were all working for China, and that China was systematically trying to take over our grid. None of this was true. You put enough money behind it, it created a lot of buzz, and it did deter the signature collection effort. So ultimately, the referendum effort did not succeed because they could not collect enough signatures.
You know, one would hope that you good folks in Ohio have the chance to rethink energy policy and to have, you know, some kind of fair dealing with how you mobilize your energy opportunities in Ohio. That just like Pennsylvania, you guys are part of the Marcellus Shale natural gas play, and that like Pennsylvania, that you guys have both the dry gas, the methane, but also the wet gas with all of the chemical byproducts that are used as feedstocks for manufacturing. Your remarks were just spot on. I mean, we need to let markets function, that this is how we get systems that work. This is how we get best outcomes and best value from these resources that, that our respective states are blessed with.
Well, and markets are driving all sorts of things. It's as I mentioned, not just price and reliability, which are certainly of benefit to all citizens and businesses, but also innovation and clean air.
Yes.
We didn't buy the argument in House Bill 6 that it was about clean air. Maybe because it also subsidized some of the oldest and highest polluting coal plants. But markets are driving cleaner emissions in power generation, and our neighbors to the east, just like Ohio, are benefiting from this natural gas. We're seeing businesses coming in and building new billion-dollar power plants to generate electricity very efficiently from that abundant natural gas. That's a much cleaner form of emission and generation, and that's happening because of markets. So this will only continue. You also have the markets for the renewable energy and energy efficiency, and those are real markets. There's greater and greater uptake there, the documented economics. It's really something. Let markets work.
Yes. At the same time that First Energy is involved with this scandal with Householder and all the stuff over House Bill 6, that the Energy Harbor, First Energy Services in Pennsylvania is working on getting Pennsylvania to enter into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which would be a carbon tax on Pennsylvania electricity generation. And Ryan, I often joke that every time that I think that I'm cynical enough, something happens that makes me realize that I need to catch up. That in fact, Energy Harbor has... They have the Beaver Valley Nuclear Facility in Pennsylvania, but across the state line in Ohio, that they have not only the nukes, but they also have their own coal-fired electricity generating plants. So they're pushing a policy in Pennsylvania that would wipe out what remains of our coal-fired power so that we'll be importing power from their coal-fired plants across the state line. So anyway, it makes your head ache trying to cope with all this. But, you know, again, as the listeners always hear me say, representative self-government is not a spectator sport. And if we as citizens, you know, don't, you know, take the time to learn the issues, to be involved, to, you know, to work through organizations like, you know, trade groups like the manufacturers or other, you know, other civic organizations, you know, other people are going to control the process and are going to, in the process, will deliver outcomes that you as a citizen consumer may not necessarily like. And again, energy policy is one of those things. Energy should be a huge competitive advantage for states like Pennsylvania and Ohio. But we need the competitive markets to be able to deliver the cost savings and the reliability, and as you mentioned, the innovation that that are going to, you know, help to energize our economies and, you know, make them strong and dynamic and robust. And that's why, you know, we can't let, you know, these deep-pocketed private interests rig the system to prevent the consumers from getting those benefits.
I couldn't agree more. You know, saying we have is, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. and energy, you know, it's a two front venue. You got to certainly keep an eye out in your state house, but you also have to watch your public services commission.
Yes,
where an awful lot of rate making decision can happen without a lot of wide understanding or daylight.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. Well, Ryan, it's great to be with you. This brings us to the end of the time that we have. Where can the listeners go to learn more about you and your organization and the work that you're doing?
Well, David, thanks. It's been a pleasure to be with you. We are at www.ohiomfg.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at OhioMFG.
Outstanding. Well, again, great thanks to our friends at Ohio Manufacturers and Ryan Augsburger, the Vice President and Managing Director for Public Policy with that outstanding organization. As ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on the Pennsylvania Cable Network with PMA Perspective. So from Ryan and me, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Governor Tom Wolf has followed a go-it-alone approach in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic since it burst upon the scene back in early March. He has been unyielding in insisting, with the possible exception of State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine, that he and he alone knows what is best for all Pennsylvanians. He has attacked and criticized those who do not submit to his every decree, even when he himself violated his own orders. The degree to which he's willing to profess his omnipotence came in late July when he got into a spat with the General Assembly over the new right-to-know law. Having come into office pledging to run the most transparent administration in history, the governor has instead emerged as a lone voice against ensuring transparency during an epidemic. Among the first state offices closed in March was the Office of Open Records, thus denying the news media, lawmakers, and taxpayers the ability to access the very information on which decisions were being made that have affected the daily lives of every Pennsylvanian. The governor's go-to attack on anybody defying his will has been to accuse them of partisan politics. This while urging the voters of Lebanon County to vote out elected officials who defied his shutdown orders. That tactic, however, could not be used in justifying his opposition to the right-to-know law. That is because something almost unheard of happened under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg. The law passed both houses of the General Assembly unanimously. Every single Republican, every single Democrat, and the one independent in the Senate were united in support of the right-to-know law. Wolf disagreed and threatened to veto the legislation. But with a veto override a certainty, he allowed the bill to become law without his signature. In the process, however, he penned a political screed saying he was doing so despite his supposedly better judgment. The unnecessary kerfuffle over the right-to-know law was the apex of Governor Wolf's go-it-alone approach. Throughout the pandemic, he has exercised dictatorial powers, confining people to their homes, closing businesses, implementing restrictions, all with little or no consultation with stakeholders, and generally with little advance notice. This pattern of unilateral decision-making was set early in the pandemic when Wolf abruptly closed the state's public schools. Administrators in the state's 500 school districts were caught off guard and given just hours to close and no time to put alternative plans into place to educate students. Then again, acting without consulting affected stakeholders, his know-it-all administration ordered so-called non-life-sustaining businesses to close. The order resulted in mass confusion as critical supply chains, some of which produced the very medical supplies needed to combat the pandemic, were disrupted. To this day, defying even a subpoena issued by the state Senate, information on the business closure process and resulting contradictory and inconsistent waiver procedures have yet to be fully revealed. Wolf even managed an amazing feat, triggering layoffs in the healthcare sector during a public health crisis. His blanket ban on elective surgeries, which remained in place until a revolt by providers, decimated hospital budgets and sent workers to the unemployment line. He even ordered a halt to construction of medical facilities, preventing the development of capacity that would have been critical had the worst-case predictions of the pandemic been realized. Wolf has vetoed bipartisan legislative efforts to reopen segments of the state's economy and has turned a deaf ear to county and local leaders who have argued his statistics and metrics, which frequently change, did not accurately reflect actual circumstances. This brings us to the current situation. After saying he would allow county officials to deal with localized spikes in COVID-19 cases as the economy reopened, he has instead placed statewide restrictions on the bar and restaurant industry. Dr. Levine claims there is data indicating they have been the source of the spread, but she has adamantly refused to release the data that led to that conclusion to the news media. And so Tom Wolf continues to rule Penn's Woods by executive fiat, unrestrained by a compliant state Supreme Court that allowed his emergency powers to remain in effect. At least until next May, when voters will have the opportunity to amend the state constitution, giving the legislature the clear authority to end those powers, Pennsylvania will be governed by a lone wolf. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WHSK-FM in Bloomsburg, WESB-AM in Bradford, along with WCAT-FM and WHMX-FM in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.